supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, for the first half of the 20th century, child rearing meant children should be seen and not heard. And then came Spock. No, not Mr. Spock, Dr. Spock. Anyway, he told us children needed to be attended to, and from then we went from child-focused to, frankly, child-obsessed. And in that time, there have been hundreds of thousands of books telling parents just how to be parents. Recently, one of the most controversial books was Amy Chua's Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother, which described a strict parenting style in the name of steering children towards excellence. On today's show, we're going to talk about this tiger parenting style in light of a new book by my guest, Kim Wong Keltner. She's written Tiger Baby Strike Back, How I Was Raised by a Tiger Mom But Could Not Be Turned to the Dark Side. It's her first work in nonfiction. In it, she rejects the notion that kids should be constantly pushed to excel to make their elders look good. She was raised this way and now parents her own daughter with, quote, plenty of hugs, praise, and play dates. Kim Wong Keltner joins us by phone from California. Kim, welcome to the show.
Hello, Dan. Thank you. It feels great to be talking to you.
A little while later, we're going to hear from Dr. Keith Cernick. He's an expert on child-parent relationships, and he's at Arizona State University. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I have a sneaking suspicion, Kim, that some of my listeners might have an opinion or two about child rearing.
All righty. That sounds great.
So, Kim, I love how your book opens when you talk about your Chinese auntie telling you that if you didn't drive a Mercedes by the time you were 38, you'd be a total loser. Then you go on to say, after graduating from UC Berkeley in 4 years, helping your husband through graduate school, raising a child, and writing 3 novels, your mother thinks you're lazy. So
that's right.
I wonder if you do, or if a part of you questions that. Does that voice live inside of you?
Well, at some point, for me personally, I learned to pursue the things that I wanted to pursue. I don't think a regular tiger baby who's been pushed to get straight A's the rest of their life, they're usually pushed into a profession such as medicine or something a little bit more science-based. And I'd never really shared my dreams of becoming a writer with my parents. That's not really on the inside track to getting your parents' attention in Chinese culture.
But I wonder, though, that voice that you grew up with to do more, to achieve more, is that, are there shadows of that that still live in there?
Definitely, as an adult, it's something that I've had to fight against.
Yeah.
When you are only being valued for your straight A's, for your perfect report card, and that's the only approval you're getting, the only love you're getting, you learn to emotionally detach in pursuit of those goals. And I really don't think emotional detachment serves you in the rest of your life. You don't make friends and know how to establish human connections, and you have to unlearn that detachment in order to be a successful human being and another a parent also, I think.
Yeah, I think unlearn is exactly the right word. You know, I know several women whose parents were raised in India, China, Taiwan, and while they might have been born in their parents' native land, they were essentially raised in this culture. Every one of them struggles with issues of respect and loyalty to their parents and for their parents' values versus establishing their own identity. And you know, I think about this, Kim, and I wonder if that's quantitatively different from everyone else.
I think it's absolutely true, in particular, from parents who, my grandparents went through World War II, and as a child, my mother left China. And I think that when you have this idea that you were escaping real poverty, you know, your parents are thinking that putting food on the table and if you have clothes on your back, that that should be enough. And they, because they were worried about real survival, they were starving for food, not just starving for affection, which is what we want. And I think there's a huge gap there. If you have been raised always having had food on the table, and you want, you're looking for emotional sustenance, and that seems indulgent, I think, to the older generations.
And understandably.
So,
I was going to say, in
Chinese culture, who you are in your family, number one son, number two daughter, how you reflect on the family is a lot more the focus. And then in America, you know, we're all telling our children, be yourself. The best thing you can be is to be yourself. Well, if you're raised Asian, what is that self? You never learn that being yourself is anything important. And so by the time you're 20, you get to college, you've been in your homework cave for 15 years just trying to get into that top college, and then you're trying to navigate all of these social situations. You don't even know what yourself is.
Yeah, you know what, though, Kim? I see that in this culture also. You know, a lot of parents say, you know, I want my child just to be happy, just to fulfill themselves. But the subtext there is, as long as it is consistent with my vision of them, you know, my expectations. And that's always the subtext. But, you know, with Asian culture, there's this powerful loyalty to parents that we don't have in this culture. That's my observation anyway. Did you feel that loyalty? Did you struggle with that?
Well, even right now I struggle with it, in that I've written this book that for me very much felt like speaking truth to power. It was shocking to me that no one had ever challenged this idea of the tiger mom, challenged the idea that maybe there were some drawbacks to pushing for success no matter what. And having written this book, a lot of people are understandably criticizing my mom. They want to know a lot more details, and I still have the urge to protect her. She didn't ask me to write this book. She didn't ask to have all of this attention heaped onto her. And you know, I'm talking about situations in my book that happened 30 years ago, and it's been quite a shock for her to think, oh my gosh, my daughter remembered this one thing that happened, and she's sort of taken aback, and she doesn't necessarily know how to talk about emotions. So I still have the urge to be loyal to her, even at the same time that I have exposed her.
Yeah, let me reintroduce you, and then I want to follow up on that. We're talking with Kim Wong Keltner, who's written Tiger Baby Strike Back. It's her first work of nonfiction, and that's what we're talking about here. I want to know how your mother felt reading the book.
I the whole time I was writing this, I did say, you know, Mom, I'm writing this story. It's a lot about me and you and about when I was growing up. And hearing that, she said, okay, fine, I accept that. And it was a very different reality, I think, when she actually read the book. And the shock of knowing that I had held on to certain things that had happened. And then within her own self-development, she's not the kind of person who is talking about how she feels. She wasn't raised that way, and you were raised to think, oh, if you were dwelling on these things, you were just considered too sensitive. And that may be true, but I don't actually like that term. I think it's very dismissive. Oh, I was only joking. Oh, you're too sensitive. I think these are ways to make somebody feel really disempowered. So we're kind of on new ground, I think, as mother and daughter, because we've never shared this language of talking about how we feel.
Well, what I want to hear about your childhood with her. I want to know. I know that's a big question, but I want to know where you lived and what it was like. I want to know, you know, were you lonely?
Okay. I grew up in San Francisco, and we did not live in a Chinese part of town, even though we went to Chinatown on the weekends, and I did have one set of grandparents who lived closer to Chinatown. But I would say that even to drive across town to get to the neighborhood where people who looked like you are, it did create a kind of separation that, you know, you go to this other place to be Chinese, to interact with other Chinese people, but at home you were separate. And I had been thinking about this for a while. In the geography of San Francisco, as you know, there's many different neighborhoods, and my parents were pretty strict in that we were in the back seat with the doors locked, you know, as you're driving across town. But I live right between Haight Street and Castro Street, and I think about how that may have affected me, that even though no one in my own family was a rebel or an iconoclast, did I say that right? You know, as we were driving by, you know, I was a little kid looking out the car window and seeing people on Haight Street, seeing people in the Castro district who, unbeknownst to me as a child, had come here for freedom of expression. And so I think that growing up, I always knew that that was an option. I didn't know how that was actually going to be an option for me. But seeing things and taking it in and growing up in a big city, seeing that there were people who had a lot more options than I seemed to have while I was simultaneously fulfilling my role as an obedient child, straight-A student.
When did you know that you were feeling constrained?
I also went to Catholic school, so that was back in the day when, you know, teachers could hit you. And it was fine. And I felt pretty constrained as early as kindergarten. You were quiet both at home and school.
You were aware of feeling constrained?
Yes, I remember being in kindergarten and being so petrified that I would do something wrong that I was pretending to be a statue. Just sitting there, you know, they said, oh, you know, feet together, hands in your lap. And the only time the teacher she pointed me out or seemed to notice me, that said, oh, look at that girl right there. That's how everyone should be sitting.
Oh, great.
And that really reinforced that feeling, just as you said, that children should be seen and not heard. But luckily, in my own mind, I had my own running dialogue. So, you know, does that make a person a writer or an artist that you, luckily for me, already had an interior life that
I think
have quietly?
One of the things that makes someone an artist or a writer is this sense of feeling different, feeling alone, you know, and that's, I think that's a birthplace of creativity. Tell me about your relationship with your mother and your father.
Well, I would say that in my parents' generation, you got married and you had kids, and that's what you did, and that's what all of their peers did as well. And I know that this is not just for Asian families, but, you know, when you're small, when you're a baby and you're a toddler and you're cute and you can still be sort of manipulated, everything is great, right? Because you're cute, you're just ambling around. But as soon as you develop a sense of rebellion or wanting to be your own person, I think that's when things got more complicated for my family, in that I was all of a sudden not wanting to just sit there and be still. And I think a lot of
How old were you, Kim?
I would say about 9 o'clock, 9 years old when I wasn't all that cute anymore. You know, your teeth are coming in kind of funky and your body's changing. You're getting a little yucky.
Yeah.
So I would say around then there was a shift of feeling like, oh, I'm not your cute little baby anymore. And feeling a little bit left out in the cold because of that. But I did have and do have two older brothers.
Yeah, I want to hear about that. How?
Yeah, that takes a little pressure off for me in that, you know, my eldest brother was really fulfilling his role as the number one son. You know, straight A's, Little League, the whole shebang. And then I had a middle brother who was kind of Bart Simpson-esque, getting into a lot of trouble. So that was sort of a distraction, and because I was a girl, I was kind of left to my own devices as long as I didn't make too much noise, which was good for me when I figured out how to read and write.
You know, reading your book, you talk about a lot of stereotypes. You know, the stereotype of Chinese people was that they did railroads, cleaners, and restaurants. And
yes.
Those were the stereotypes. But doesn't the whole concept of Tiger Mom or Revenge of the Tiger Mom, doesn't that contribute to a stereotype of Chinese women?
Well, when the Tiger Mom phenomenon sort of blew up in the popular culture, I thought a lot about it in that people would ask, I'd be out with my kid in a stroller and strangers and acquaintances were all asking me, oh, are you a Tiger Mom? And I had not read the book yet, and I thought, wow, this is kind of crazy. People used to just think I was a waitress in a Chinese restaurant. Now they're asking me if I'm a Tiger Mom. And it seemed really outlandish to me that these were the two prevalent stereotypes, as if there could be nothing in between. And I think that the idea of a Tiger Mom did reflect this dragon lady idea that it was just sort of a new version of a inaccessible, angry, controlling person who has been in the media and in movies very much so. So as I was writing this book, you know, not quite at the beginning, did I realize that the stereotype of this Tiger Mom also needed compassion.
You realized that
it was,
when you were writing
that
your book.
It was kind of an easy answer. Yeah. And that's why I have one chapter titled Origin of the Tiger Mother Species. You know, where did this come from? And I wanted to trace back to how limited the roles for Chinese women were, and through the different decades, who would I be if I were a woman in the 20s or the 30s or the 40s, and how would I feel? How, you know, what was it like for my own mother being a secretary in the 1960s and 1970s? You know, she was trying to raise children, to be a wife, to be a woman, and to feel her femininity, but she herself had the same expectations like I am rained down on her. Her parents weren't hugging her either.
Right.
And frankly, of all of my parents' friends, my parents were considered the most lenient of all of them.
So it turns out your mother needed exactly what you needed, and that was understanding.
Exactly. She never got any reassurances either. In her day, she was just supposed to be a wife and mother, and if she worked, she would be a secretary and not necessarily expected, you know, just like any, just like most women, American women of that time.
We've got to take a short break, and then we're going to bring in psychologist Keith Cernick. But I want to read a quote and get your reaction. You paraphrased British poet Philip Larkin, and he said, here's the quote, "They F you up, your Chinese mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do." Do you consider yourself effed up by your parents?
Well, very much in the way that everyone is. You know, we all are a big jumble of juxtapositions. And, you know, do I think that I'm effed up? No, because I think I'm me, and I'm, you know. But in that way that we all have to figure it out, we all have to unravel what our particular problems are. But I am trying to unravel those things. I think that for everyone, how do we make sense of where we came from and where we want to go?
Yeah, well, you found it when you were writing the book, We Do It With Compassion.
That's right. For
ourselves and for those around us. Well, like I said, we've got to take a very short break, and we'll be back in just 1 minute. We're talking with Kim Wong Keltner about her book, Tiger Baby Strike Back. When we come back, we'll be also joined by Keith Cernick, a child clinical psychologist. Our phone number here is 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. We're going to be talking about different approaches to child rearing and their implications. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Whether you are a college-bound senior or are thinking of getting a graduate degree, you'll have questions ranging from, what are the classes like, to what activities can I do, to where will this lead my career? To help students with their questions, USciences is holding a series of on-campus summer open houses. Prospective students are invited to tour the campus, talk to students, faculty, and staff, and learn about the admission and financial aid process. Details at usciences.edu/openhouse.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has been providing services to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Founded locally by pioneering schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization now helps individuals across our nation to live healthier, happier, and more productive lives. Over the next 6 weeks, Wawa stores throughout southeastern Pennsylvania and New Jersey will help support Devereaux's work. More details at local Wawa stores.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about child rearing with Kim Wong Keltner, who's written Tiger Babies Strike Back, How I Was Raised by a Tiger Mom But Could Not Be Turned to the Dark Side. Well, I'm also joined now by Keith Cernick. He's a child clinical psychologist. He's a foundation professor and department chair in the Department of Psychology at Arizona State University. Keith, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, Ken, we hear in psychologists' language about a tiger mom. What is a tiger mom?
Well, I thought that Kim did a pretty good job of describing it in a lot of ways, but I think that what the key to it, I think, in a lot of ways, is having very, very high expectations, sort of harshly presented, and it's not balanced with that sense of support and love and, you know, sort of that unconditional love that I think we all sort of strive for and want to provide. So it's that lack of balance between those two things.
When I read your mission statement at the parent-child relations lab that you run, it said you look at processes that potentially increase the experience of stress in the family. So
right.
Let's, for a minute, take a look at this particular context. No real mental health problems emerge, but this kind of parenting, does it increase stress, increase risk?
Well, I think it does, but it's always a balance, and I thought that one of the points that Kim raised, too, it's a really good point at the end there. How has she sort of dealt with this, and how has she turned out as a mom in relation to her own experience of being parented? And the kids bring something to the table, right? So there are aspects to being a child and your characteristics and your sort of level of, for lack of a better word right now, we'll use resilience, all right, that you have. And depending upon what your characteristics are, you're more or less vulnerable to the types of parenting that you might receive. So some kids might, get a relatively harsh parent that's not very supportive or warm and still do okay with that. And some kids don't do very well with that. So the stress that it creates is somewhat dependent upon the child and that child's characteristics that they bring to the table. So it's going to vary. It's not uniform across families.
So it's like the goodness of fit model.
That's exactly.
About how well a child's character fits with a parent's character.
Well, that's right. That's a classic sort of concept in psychology, and child psychology in particular, that goodness of fit between that parent and that parent's characteristics and processes and the child and theirs really determines a lot of how that process works and the degree to which that might be stressful.
I want to turn to you, Kim, and I want to quote Keith here. In one of his statements, he said that a parent-child relationship is critical to both the child and the parent's well-being. And to be honest, Kim, I never thought about the second half of that equation. It's critical to the parent's well-being also. I wonder about have you ever thought about your mother's sense of well-being?
I have, and in my book, Tiger Baby Strike Back, I do talk about when I had my own daughter, Lucy, affection that my mother could not necessarily show to me, she immediately showed to Lucy from the second she was born. I have a part where my husband is in the waiting room and they're looking through that glass at this newborn infant, my daughter, and he saw my mother cry. And we had already been married for 8 years before we had ever had Lucy, and he had never seen her cry before. And he said, gosh, I saw your mother crying. It kind of freaked me out. And in that sense, I think that this baby was able to open her heart, and I then subsequently go on to describe how my mom, in a way, through babysitting Lucy, became a younger woman, just as I was feeling older and creaky and sleepless. My mom had kind of a reawakening, and I think it kind of put her in touch with who she was as a younger person. So I definitely think that there is a transfer of feelings and openness that as the child, as an adult child, I feel like I want to help my mother open up more.
Well, I have to tell you, and I think a lot of grandparents will agree with me, there's something about seeing our grandchild. We don't have a job to do. We've got no responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
All we have to do is love and enjoy this baby. Man, it's so much better than being a parent. I guess I shouldn't have said that to you. I'm sorry about that. Listen, we're talking about child rearing and are we doing too much? Are we doing too little? What are the essential ingredients in child rearing? Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I wonder about that goodness of fit thing that we talked about, Keith, and how do we sort through that? How do we figure out whose character matches whose and what can be done about it?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think that we're still working on that in a lot of ways, right? Even though this concept has been around for quite some time. The characteristics that we think really go into this, we know a little bit about things that have to do with children's temperaments, right, very early on. And, we used to talk about what might be sort of easy babies and difficult babies. And, and think about, are parents that, are easily overwhelmed or easily stressed or maybe don't have high skill sets as parents, right? If they match up with a difficult baby, well, that may not be a good match, right? And that can be sort of predictive of more difficult processes over time. And so sometimes you hope that you get, an easy baby paired with a parent that might have, less skill sets, but we don't get what we want or what we need necessarily all the time. We get what we get, right? And so those are issues that we deal with and that we try to understand. But there's so many factors that come into play. It's not so simple a thing. The goodness to fit in and of itself is going to determine the nature of that relationship, because there's so many other facets that come in, which may be sometimes, you know, grandparents who are available, other support systems that operate within families to sort of take what are difficult circumstances and make them better. So we really look for sort of this larger contextual kinds of sense of things to help determine how we can help the quality of parent-child relationships.
All right. I've got the impossible question for you, and it's an unreasonable question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So we have these little babies, and on the one hand, we've got the type of parents that say, you know, our responsibility is only to nurture their soul and let them develop into whoever they're going to develop into. And then there's the other approach at the other end of the continuum, saying these children have to be taught to protect themselves, to achieve, to be able to function independently, so on and so forth. How do we figure out what's what and for which child? That's the impossible question.
It is a very difficult question. Well, you know what? I think that, you know, I'm going to give a lot of credit to parents here, because I think that, you know, the vast majority of parents are really, I think, very incredible people that do an amazing job, and that they do pay attention to the information that their children give them, right? They don't do that necessarily explicitly. I think it's an implicit process for a lot of parents that are naturally sensitive to what their kids need. And now they then take their own characteristics within that, and it could be that, you know, there are elements of parents that are that maybe are tiger parent like, right? That you have very high expectations and very high demands. That may not be a bad thing for some kids, as long as you do that within the framework of also being sensitive to what those kids' needs are and making sure that you can be also sort of positively affected with them, right? So I think that all of the time we're trying to balance the fact that our job as parents is something in between those systems, right? Where you want to teach your children to, you know, how to protect themselves in very competitive kinds of environments out there, right? And to be reasonably competitive people, but in the context of also understanding who they are, that success can be defined in a lot of different ways, and it's not just one model.
Well, Kim, I think you had the answer as far as I'm concerned, because when Jennifer Lynn spoke with you earlier, you said the difficulties happen with tiger moms, and frankly all parents, when we're not being conscious of our own anxieties and needs. You know, I've been practicing mindfulness meditation for nearly 20 years, and being conscious is not as easy as it sounds.
That's right, especially when you're operating on a third of the sleep that you're used to getting. I have been listening to what you're both saying, Keith and Dan, and I think that we could agree that lots of parents, not just Asian parents, are living through their children's accomplishments. And as the adult, you have to be the one to ask yourself, am I pushing my child for me and passing it off as it being good for them? We are unconsciously doing things all the time, and it is our responsibility, I think, as the one who's, you know, 20, 30 years older than the squiggling blob, it's our responsibility to not check out and be on autopilot. I think there's a way to keep your kid clean and safe and nurture their soul at the same time. First of all, accepting and realizing that they do have a soul separate from you, the parent. And also, if we can somehow hang on loosely and not so tight, you know, everyone I know, every parent I know who has drawn a line in the sand and said, I will not cross that, you know, for instance, like, there will be no eating in the car, you know, that always goes really well, right? We've all been there when the milk goes exploding across and poured into the upholstery to be smelled for, you know, the next 5 years.
I want to challenge that. When my kids were young, My wife told me I couldn't eat in the car, and I didn't. Of course,
okay.
The kids were allowed, but I wasn't allowed because I was more messy than they were. But we can't.
Did that work? Did that work for you?
No.
You were not eating in the car, but
no.
the rule was not for them.
No, of course. You can't do lines in the sand. You can't do it anywhere in life. And, you know, but I think you're really on to something. And Keith, I want you to weigh in on this, that parents should know what's going on inside of them, know what their own values are, know what their own dreams are for themselves, let alone their children. I mean, it really...
Well, I think that that's true. I mean, we hope, right, that people have that sense of themselves. I think that, you know, I mean, there's no doubt that Kim's right. I mean, there's a lot of parents and probably all of us to some extent sort of get a little bit of confusion between that sort of sense of pride we take in our kids with their successes and, you know, the feelings of living through that, okay? That it's not always clear maybe what those differentiations might be. Mm. But I also think that, you know, having that awareness and being able to do that, you know, and I think that we'll probably all agree to the fact that being a parent is a very difficult job, right? I mean, there's a lot of difficult traps that we can fall into and that we're not all perfect sort of psychological beings ourselves. And thinking about how to negotiate that process through the challenges that we face as parents, I think, makes our job difficult. But I think that again, I go back to the sense that I think that most parents are very well-intentioned, just they don't always match their behavior to that intention.
It really is a tough job being a parent. I mean, you know, I'm looking at the three of us, psychologists and writers, and, you know, I mean, the three of us can easily fake it, you know, but you just can't. You can't as a parent. You just don't get away with that. We've got to take a short break. We're going to come back and talk more about this, and we're going to take some phone calls also when we get back. We're talking about parenting, and we're doing it with Kim Wong Keltner, who's the author of Tiger Baby Strike Back, How I Was Raised by a Tiger Mom But Couldn't Be Turned to the Dark Side. Keith Cernick is a child psychologist. He's a foundation professor and the department chair, Department of Psychology at Arizona State University. We've got a couple of lines open. We'd love to hear from you. Please weigh in about parenting. How were you parented? How do you parent your children? That's 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
One in three families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, aged 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
On Tell Me More, we talk politics, culture, money, parenting, and even hear wisdom from a few unexpected sages like boxer businessman George Foreman.
Money is a good thing, but every morning you have to get up with something no one else in the world gets up with. That face you see in the mirror, you gotta love it.
Join us for distinctive and surprising conversations next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb talking with Kim Wong Keltner and Keith Cernick about parenting. Keltner's an author, written Tiger Baby Strike Back. Cernick is a child psychologist. And we've got some callers who want to join the conversation. We'll start with Pam on line 4. Hi, Pam.
Hello.
Hi, Pam.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm a mom on this new mindfulness. I'm really, really getting into being aware and sensitive of myself and the needs of my children. And in the meantime, my 17-year-old daughter is pulling away from me emotionally. And my mindfulness, I have to just really be in touch with so that I can feel where she's coming from. Because, of course, she's telling me I don't know who she is. So I've decided that I need a hug and a kiss every day. And one day I pulled her to the side and I said, darling, I need a hug and a kiss every day. Can I get that from you? And she's sort of like, right, I guess so if you need one. But I know over the last month or so, the more I do it, the more she's connecting to me. But I found, and I'm beginning to torture myself saying, maybe you were a tiger mom. Maybe you did too much. Maybe she pulled away from you because you were too strict and you wanted this and you demanded that. And now she's all tense about becoming the person you want her to be. And so I want the love back. Do you know what I'm saying? And now that she's 17, it's like, wow, it's such hard territory to try to find my way, you know, into her life while she's trying to find her independence.
Yeah, so one of the byproduct of parenting is we beat ourselves up no matter what. And consider the fact that she's pulling away because she's 17. You know, I often treat families, and I want to hear Keith and Kim weigh in on this. I often treat families, and you can imagine how often I hear 17-year-olds saying, you don't know me, you don't get me. And I take that as an opportunity, and I tell parents that if your child says that to you, take it at face value and assume that they're right, that you don't get them. And that's an opportunity for discussion. Help me. Help me get you. You're right. I don't get you. If you feel that way, I don't. Then tell me. Help me. I'm wide open here. And if you can, you know, listen, like I say, with a curious mind and an open heart, hopefully you can have a discussion. But I would like to hear from Kim and Keith on that. Kim, you want to weigh in first?
Sure. Sure. I think it's funny. My daughter is only just almost 10, but seeds of that same idea are there already. I write in my book about how even as a tiny child, I wanted Lucy to know, I see you. You know, I would look right at her and want to give her the feeling that you're not just an appendage to me. You're not just here to look cute in that perfectly matching outfit. I see that you're your own person. And I think that, you know, as the child gets older and at 17, there is a natural rebellion that's good. I think it's important for the parent to always remember that it's okay to say, I'm not always right, or I don't know. And I think that this idea of the tiger mom who's so authoritarian, the idea is I know what's right and you will do what I do or what I say because it's my way or the highway. And I think that's really a failure on even just as being an adult, even if you're not a parent, if you can't occasionally say, I don't have the answer, I can learn too. I'm still open to learn new things.
Keith?
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting sort of thing for 17-year-olds in particular, and Dan, sort of you raised this too. I mean, adolescence is a very difficult time, and I'm going to guess that on some level she probably doesn't know herself that well either yet and
sure.
Figuring that out. So it's going to be difficult for other people to know your daughter as well. But I would also suggest that, you know, if you think back over the course of your relationship with your daughter over time, that, you know, that's going to give you some clues about where it may be in the future, too. And that through these difficult sort of periods of adjustment the kids go through, where they're becoming an adult in their own right, I think the idea that you can be open to learning about them, and Dan, your comments, I thought were right on the money about that, but also thinking that, you know, that historically, there's some relevance to, you know, what's going to happen in the future here too, when you work your way through these situations that are transitional situations and important developmental transitions. So take advantage of that opportunity, as Dan suggests, and think about your history and understand that it will more than likely work its way through.
Mm. Great, great advice. And Pam, good luck with that. And, you know, use your mindfulness to, you know, get in touch and learn to tolerate your own anxiety about her pulling away from you. Wish you the best. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Lucky on the line. Hi, Lucky.
Hi, Dan. Thank you very much for taking my call. I really appreciate your program all the time.
Thank you.
And this is something about the children, and I think the behavior of tiger moms are typical of people who are perfectionists, I think. I myself is tagged as a perfectionist, not that I admit that. The thing is, when I have some art forms like sewing and crocheting and tacking, and whenever I make the artwork, I go back to correct. So a child is our creation, and we want that to be perfect. And I've always told my daughter, if I have to yell at her or discipline her, it's been with the intention of making her survive better in life and be a better person. And in fact, I made a deal with her when she was young. If I made a mistake of yelling at her unnecessarily when I was mad, when I came back from work or something, and if she could justify, I would, at the bedtime before I went to sleep and she went to sleep, I would have that conversation with her. And I would say, if that was a mistake on my part, then I would drop a dollar in the piggy bank. Either way, I would drop a dollar in the piggy bank for her. But I wanted her to know that the reason why I yelled at her or had to be like that. And moreover, if it came to really, really being, they try to push, I think. Sometimes they have a demand of their own. So in that sense, I always went upstairs.
It sounds like, and I really want to hear Kim's reaction, it sounds like, yes, you're a perfectionist, but Kim, early on, we were talking about lack of emotional availability. It sounds like Lucky was emotionally available to her child. Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to one of the first things you said, Lucky, that you think that this child is our creation. And even just the language of that sentence, you know, before our baby was born, my husband and I talked a lot about this. I remember when I was little, my mom very much tried to instill in me, you must do what I say because I made you. And I don't know if it was just my own innate sensibility, but I felt like you didn't make me. I came through you. And I'm always trying to be aware of this as a parent myself, that this is an individual being, and I'm here to guide her through life, but I didn't make her. She's not my creation. So in that sense, just to take a step back, listen to our language, I think that's an important point.
I would like you, though, Kim, to weigh in on Lucky's relationship with her. I don't recall if it was a son or a daughter. I think daughter.
Mm-hmm.
What were your feelings as you were listening to those discussions she was having?
Well, I think that it's great that as a parent, Lucky could say, this is the reason I yelled at you, or this was a mistake on my part. That's great to be able to admit that, I would love it if my parent could say to me, you know, I'm sorry I spoke in anger. I mean, that's a first step in itself. I think that these small steps to even be able to talk about why we were angry and not just pretend you didn't say it, I think that's very significant.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lucky, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate your call and the perspective. Kim, I want to say, as I read your book, you sounded pretty angry at your mother. And at one point, your husband asked you if it was time you eased up on her. What did you say to him?
I said, no, not yet. And I do think that comes from a feeling, if you let if you let these things build up and you haven't ever spoken about them, then you can't move past it. So I think that in an adult child, you know, I'm 43 and I know 70-year-old people too who are still harboring their resentments towards their parents. And for me to write about this in this book, Tiger Baby Strike Back, I was really wanting to say it for so many adults that, you know, we're still living with this pain from childhood and we are still angry and sad about it and dealing with the loneliness that being pushed only for certain goals, how that instilled in us just a feeling of separateness from our parents. And it may come across as me trying to get back at my mom, but it's really, my ultimate goal is to actually feel closer to her.
You, in the very beginning of the show, you used the phrase, speak truth to power. And mm-hmm. And I wonder, after writing this book, does it still feel like the power is with your mother? That she still...
Or do you feel more empowered? I definitely feel more empowered, although, you know, my parent will always have power over me. I think it is, interestingly enough, up to the person who feels like something bad was done to them. It's like, I can't let that rule my life anymore.
Right.
I'm 43 and I have my own kid to take care of. And I can't be a good parent to her if I'm still, you know, looking back at past hurts and not moving through
it. And I think, unfortunately, we're out of time, but, I think one of the ways to become empowered is to feel compassion, like you said earlier. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. It's been a great show and very important.
Thank you, Dan.
Kim Wong Keltner is the author of Tiger Babies Strike Back. And Keith Cernick is a child clinical psychologist. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about fatherly wisdom. Well, you can continue the conversation by going to whyy.org/voices, and you can download this show there also. Follow us. We're at Twitter at Voices in the Fam, and I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is the executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. And Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends.